You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
A recent New York Times article about White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer opened with, "As long as you don't care too much about facts, you can learn a lot from a Sean Spicer daily briefing." Mr. Spicer has been given the task of defending President Trump's assertions that he had a bigger inauguration crowd than President Obama, that the travel ban was not a ban, that President Obama wiretapped the Trump campaign, and a number of other generally unprovable claims. The daily White House briefings used to be somewhat tame affairs, but how much that has changed is the subject of New Yorker editorial staff writer Andrew Marantz's latest piece, "Is Trump Trolling the White House Press Corps?" It's in the March 20th issue of the New Yorker, and I'm very pleased it has brought Andrew Marantz to our show today. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Weren't the press briefings under President Obama's press secretaries, Robert Gibbs, Jay Carney, and Josh Earnest, pretty sedate?
Yeah, they didn't make for great television, you could put it that way.
And you found only one exchange during President Obama's 8 years in office that made headlines?
Yeah, they weren't really, you know, they were opportunities for the press to get information. They weren't in and of themselves a great show most of the time.
So who was that between the one that made headlines?
Oh, there was a sort of tense exchange between Jay Carney and Jonathan Carl of ABC News. Jonathan Carl was one of the kind of front row reporters who is kind of one of the deans of the briefing room, you know, a kind of a person that people look to as a moderate tone, you know, a reporter who holds the line. And in that instance, he felt he wasn't getting straightforward information about how Obamacare enrollment was working. So it was a dispute about logistics, about policy.
Well, the same sort of thing we're seeing today, only from a different angle.
Yes and no. We're seeing similar contentiousness, but it's over much more basic things.
Didn't President Trump put Sean Spicer immediately into the crosshairs of the media on the day that he was inaugurated?
Yeah, there was – inauguration day was January 20th. On January 21st, Trump sent Spicer out to the podium to baldly lie. And so that was not a testy exchange about logistics. That was a very fundamental misuse of that office.
And we have a clip.
"Inaccurate numbers involving crowd size were also tweeted. No one had numbers because the National Park Service, which controls the National Mall, does not put any out. This was the largest audience to ever witness an inauguration, period. These attempts to lessen the enthusiasm of the inauguration are shameful and wrong."
And it turns out, just looking at the photographs, that he's not telling the truth.
Yeah, this is what the kids call gaslighting on the internet. It's patently false, and it was just an interesting opening move because the form was similar to past confrontations. It was formally similar, the tone was similar, but the content was completely different.
Do we know if the president watches Sean Spicer's news conferences on TV? Because he watches a lot of television.
He does. He watches a lot of television. This was one of the most interesting things I learned from talking to people in the briefing room, that it was unthinkable in the past for a president to watch a press briefing. The whole point of a press briefing is that the president doesn't have time to take an hour out of his day to brief the press. And yet the indication that I heard from a lot of people is that Trump seems to be watching from elsewhere in the White House.
And didn't David Corn of Mother Jones suggest that sometimes Sean Spicer is passing notes during briefings with big red marks? Should we assume that they were passed on from the president?
Yeah, David Corn wasn't one of the people I talked to for this piece. There are different theories of how this might work. The theory that makes the most sense to me is that he's texting someone like Kellyanne and immediately giving feedback, because otherwise there's a bit of a problem of getting the notes to the podium.
How did he react to Spicer's debut press briefing?
Reports were mixed. We're getting a lot of this second and third hand. And, of course, the administration doubts the validity of any anonymous sourcing unless it's their sources. But he seemed pleased. Trump has a long track record of liking any information that is positive to him and disliking any information that isn't. It doesn't have to be tethered to the facts.
And I don't know if he's pleased or not, but Spicer's briefings, which are broadcast live on C-SPAN, have earned some of the highest ratings for daytime television. I gather they beat out programs like General Hospital and The Bold and the Beautiful.
Yeah, the briefings are pretty amazing television.
So this is another kind of soap opera?
Yeah, it's a reality show. This is what Trump does well. The whole school of thought that Trump was unprepared as a political candidate only makes sense if you think of political candidates as needing to have relevant policy experience. If you think of them as just needing to be good at making compelling television and being good at branding themselves through the mass media, that's something Trump knows how to do.
You observe that as press secretary, Sean Spicer is often tongue-tied, he's enraged, or both. How does the press react to that? Do they smell blood?
Yeah, sometimes. Sometimes they circle around. Look, they are both at an advantage and a disadvantage under Spicer. The advantage is that he sometimes is easy to trip up and get him to contradict himself. And the disadvantage is, A, he doesn't seem to care when he contradicts himself. And B, there's no more conventional kind of guarantee that the big shot reporters will get the time and access and attention they're used to. So they can't press him too hard because he can always just leave them in the dust.
I'd like to quote an exchange over the use of the word ban for the president's executive order. When reporters pointed out that President Trump was the one who had used the word ban, Spicer replied that the president was merely using the words the media is using. But the president himself called it a ban, the reporter continued. I understand that, Spicer said. So is he confused, or are you confused? The reporter continued. I'm not confused. The words being used to describe it derive from what the media is calling this.
It gets pretty Orwellian pretty quickly. I think the goal in the past was to spin. You know, politicians and their spokespeople have always dissembled and misidentified and mislabeled information. But the spin was always supposed to be plausible in the past. And I think the signal you saw right from that first moment on January 21st is they're not going for plausibility anymore.
And so why bother having a press briefing if the people who you're talking to keep on catching you up?
Because it's not for the people in the room. It's for the base. It's for the people at home.
When Sean Spicer gives a press briefing, he does it in the James S. Brady press briefing room in the West Wing. Can you describe the scene?
It's a bunch of blue fold-down chairs. There are 49 of them, and the chairs are reserved by outlet. The White House Correspondents Association decides who sits in which seat.
Certain traditions from the past?
Absolutely. How august the outlet is, how serious they are about the coverage, how dedicated they are to the beat. But what the White House Correspondents Association does not decide is who's in the room. The White House is in charge of that. So you can be in the room even if you don't have a reserved seat. You can sit in the aisle. Those are the reporters that I sort of lovingly referred to as floaters in the piece.
But the traditional news organizations are the AP, Reuters, the biggest TV networks. They're in the front rows. Then blogs like Politico and Real Clear Politics are near the middle. BuzzFeed and the BBC, because it's not American, even though it's a major news outlet, that's in the back?
Yeah, the White House beat is not as central to what the BBC does. And I got a lot of pushback for calling Politico a blog, but the point being, Politico does great coverage, obviously, but they're a newer organization. They haven't been on the beat as long. So these are all very qualitative judgments that the WHCA is making.
What would Politico like to be called? I think of them as an app because it's on my phone.
Yeah, I mean, all of these things are kind of meaningless. Everything is a multimedia channel these days. But I think the point is that there's a lot of touchiness over how different outlets are identified, and understandably so, because how important you are, how significant you are, how big an audience you have, these determine real things like what kind of access you get.
I'm speaking with Andrew Marantz of the editorial staff of The New Yorker. His article that we're discussing is Trump Trolling the White House Press Corps? Was in the March 20th issue of The New Yorker. How much longer can the press continue to cover these briefings as if they're real? Because there are these constant things that come up, like the time when Spicer said that British intelligence had been working with the Obama administration to wiretap Trump Tower.
This is the world we live in now, the world where you have to say Trump, without evidence, says TK. You know, that it's this impossible bind for the press because you have to quote what the president says, but you also have to identify it as inaccurate when it is inaccurate. You know, there's been a movement toward boycotting the briefings, which wouldn't work, A, because it just doesn't make sense to not pay attention to what the president of the United States says, and B, because the people who are on board with ideas about boycotting the administration are not the only people in the room. There are plenty of people who would continue to show up.
But I wonder about whether we should just assume that Sean Spicer, when he says something, is really saying the same thing that the president would say. Kellyanne Conway has lost credibility, and now she isn't sent out except to very friendly outlets. Stephen Miller's attempt to replace Conway didn't go well. And now Sarah Huckabee Sanders is being sent out there. Will the administration just continue to put new faces out there? And is Sean Spicer likely to last very long?
There's different schools of thought about that. I see no reason. Look, the week I was there, Spicer's reputation kind of goes up and down on a moment-to-moment basis. I mean,
The week you were there representing The New Yorker?
Yes, the week I was
and
there.
Where were you seated?
I was not seated. We don't
you
have a
floater.
Seat. Yeah, I was a floater. So, and I was kind of a meta-floater. But we were seeing Spicer's kind of moment-by-moment reputation go up and down. And really, the only reputation that matters is the one that the president holds of his spokesperson. And by Thursday of the week I was there, the briefing that day was canceled at the last minute in a big surprise move, and Trump essentially said, "Look, Mr. Spicer, let me show you how it's done." And he moved all the reporters into the East Room and held a big boy presidential press conference in which he bizarrely ranted for 77 minutes and then denied that he was ranting. That was, I think, a display of a kind of alpha male peacocking, if you will, like a you know, I'm the only great salesman on the face of the earth, and I will show you how to sell a message.
He just said to Time magazine, "I'm the president and you're not."
Yep. That's
a la Chevy Chase.
That seems to be his message. So I think no matter who it is, Spicer, Conway, Huckabee, whoever, they're going to be out of the loop. And the fact is the president is out of the loop sometimes, too. I mean, just yesterday he was on his way back into the White House telling a reporter, "I need to go call to round up some more health care votes." And the reporter had to tell him, "No, they postponed the vote, Mr. President. You don't need to do that." So things are happening so chaotically that no one's in the loop.
The president's favorability rating is at 37% now. How much of this do you think is a result of what we're seeing with Spicer and the other spokespeople for the president, or the president taking over and handling the press conference himself?
If I had to guess, and no one can really know, but I think the sparring with the press is on balance good for his approval rating. I think the people who want to see him win see any contentious sparring with the press as a win for him.
Because the press is a lying group of people.
The enemy of the American people.
But do you think that 37% of the American public thinks that the press is the enemy of the American people?
It's hard to say. One thing we now know is that polls are difficult to trust. But look, the rhetoric is being amped up to a point where, of course, it's absurd. And yet there's always this argument that people use that you should take him seriously, but not literally. That's the argument that continually gets trotted out.
Going to take a little break. When we come back, we'll talk about the floaters and your experiences with one of them. My guest is Andrew Marantz, who is on the editorial staff of The New Yorker. His article, "Is Trump Trolling the White House Press Corps?" is in the March 20th issue of The New Yorker. Stay with us for more. We're back with New Yorker editorial staff writer Andrew Marantz, whose latest piece is Is Trump Trolling the White House Press Corps in the March 20th issue of The New Yorker. You mentioned the floaters. Who are the correspondents being referred to as floaters?
You can get a day pass from the White House to enter the briefing room, and it's actually not that hard to do. So when I was there, Ed Schultz, formerly of MSNBC, now of RT, was a floater. The guy from Sputnik News was a floater. They were sort of packing the aisles because there's increased interest in these early days of the Trump administration. I said the paradigm of a floater was this guy, Raghubir Goyal, who doesn't even seem to work for a newspaper at all, but he's been there for decades.
He's been attending briefings since the Carter administration. Do we know whether he writes for anyone?
He doesn't seem to. No one can find his newspaper, seems to be defunct, but he asks questions and he's actually sort of useful to the press secretaries.
And his name has become a verb to Goyo. Yeah. What does it mean?
Well, if you're a press secretary and you're in a tight spot and you want to get out of it, which happens frequently, you can Goyle your way out, is what I called it, which is just call on someone like Goyle who's going to ask either a question that's not related to the line of questioning at hand or something that might be lighten the mood in the room. So we know that Goyle likes to ask about Indo-Pakistani relations. And so that will get us off the subject of, you know, let's say Obamacare. And that's what you need to do sometimes.
How did FLOTUS become what the White House press corps now has described as an existential threat?
So one person described it to me as a kind of court packing, which has a bit of the sort of self-seriousness that people deride in the mainstream media sometimes. And yet there is something to that charge in that anyone can be brought into those floater positions. And what has been happening more and more under the Trump administration is, as we know, Trump and the people around him like new media, especially when it accords with their views. So there are a lot of news organizations, such as Breitbart being the most obvious example, also the Daily Caller, the Daily Signal, One America News. There are many, many institutions.
LifeZ, which is LifeZ, a tabloid founded by Laura Ingraham.
LifeZ is a great example. So in the first official briefing, or I think it was the second official briefing, the first question almost always in any briefing goes to the Associated Press. That's just convention. Obviously, it's not a law. It's not in the Constitution. It's just a norm. And instead of doing that, Spicer called on LifeZ first. And the reporter was obviously surprised. He was standing in the aisle. He doesn't have a seat. You know, there's nothing wrong with being a new media institution founded in 2015, but it's just they're not usually given this amount of attention. And Laura Ingraham is an open and close ally of the president's. It's a very unusual situation.
And what question did the reporter from LifeZ ask?
He essentially asked, why aren't you moving fast enough to shut down DACA, the program to keep immigrant children in the country if they meet a certain set of requirements? So it was essentially a hard line. Why aren't you holding to a harder line on immigration?
A kind of a softball question for Sean Spicer. Actually, the first briefing, as we mentioned, the one that we played, didn't go well for Spicer. So on the second one, he didn't call on the Associated Press, which in theory represents all of the news media. He called on the New York Post, whose reporter sitting in the fifth row was kind of surprised.
Yeah.
What did he ask Spicer?
He said, when are you going to build the wall? So, look, there's no law that says you have to ask a particular question or you have to ask it in a particular way. These are norms, not legal statutes. And yet, the worry is that if the norms change inch by inch, bit by bit, then there's no one who's asking tough questions, questions that are oppositional to the agenda. Even more core than that, more fundamental than that, it chips away at the notion that there is, as you say, such a thing as an outlet that represents the entirety of the American people.
But in time, couldn't all the questions still be asked? How do Spicer's briefings compare in length and depth with the ones that preceded, the ones in the Obama administration?
They've tended to be shorter. Many people from the president down in the Obama administration had a proclivity toward the professorial, and that's no longer the case. So some of them are 30 minutes long with 10 minutes of introductory remarks. They seem like some of them have been longer, in fairness to him, but many of them seem like attempts to sort of get out of the room without getting pinned down to anything.
Didn't a TV correspondent tell you that calling on front row reporters first isn't just about appealing to their egos? What does it mean for the press and for the American public?
Well, I about half believe it. I mean, one of the tricky things about this piece is that TV reporters do have big egos and they do want to be given a certain amount of deference that they may or may not deserve. And yet, beyond that kind of unfortunate part, there is something to the notion that there should be predictability, there should be normality. The press should be afforded a certain amount of respect. Look, beyond the specifics or particulars of any given press briefing, it is clearly the agenda of this administration to delegitimize the idea of facts, the notion of objective information. Objective information is a very tricky thing to procure. Philosophers have worried about it for a long time. It's not a shoo-in. It's not a slam dunk. And yet, it has to at least be theoretically possible for one thing to be more authoritative than another.
Although pretty much every president during my lifetime has seen the press as an enemy at some point or other.
Right, but they tend to say it privately. We didn't find out that Nixon had literally referred to the press as the enemy until the Watergate tapes came out. And many presidents feel unfairly maligned. They feel singled out. Clinton hated the press. Obama punished leakers. It's always been a contentious relationship, but this kind of open warfare, almost in a reality show playing out in front of the public kind of way, is unique and many people think uniquely damaging.
On top of the floaters, hasn't Sean Spicer added an innovation to the press briefings, the so-called Skype seats? What are they, and how do I apply for one?
I don't know if you're too close. You have to be very far away from Washington to get one. Look, the Skype seats are a perfect example of something that there's a good argument for them and they sound very good on paper. The notion is smaller outlets from far away, geographic diversity, ideological diversity, let's bring new people into the room. So you have a local reporter from West Palm Beach who's talking about how, you know, the winter White House, so-called the Mar-a-Lago, has affected her local beat. You have someone from Las Vegas, someone from Providence, Rhode Island. This sounds really good on paper. What people worry about is what someone on Twitter called the Skype-a-fans, the people who on Skype call in with a pre-scripted and somewhat sycophantic question.
So do you have to be a Trump supporter to win a Skype seat? One of them was a newspaper owner in Kentucky who supported the president. Another one was a talk radio host named Lars Larson, who has been a strong supporter. And an officer, this was my favorite, an officer in the Navy Reserve who addressed Sean Spicer as Commander Spicer.
Yeah, yeah. Well, actually, Spicer is an officer in the Navy, which is why his title is Commander, which is why he said that. I think, look, you don't have to be a Trump supporter to get a seat. I think people from these right-wing news organizations argue, I think plausibly, that there were many members of the press under the Obama administration who seemed to be pretty clearly Obama supporters and who asked him softball questions like, what has most enchanted you about serving in this office? And so their argument is that the liberal mainstream media has existed for a long time and this is a counterbalance. And I think there's something to that.
And you said that it also appeals to the base when the president goes after the press, the fake news media, failing at New York Times, at NBC News, ABC, CBS, CNN. It's not my enemy. It's the enemy of the American people. A lot of people on the right are calling CNN Communist News Network, even though CNN in the past was often criticized for being bland and so straight down the middle.
Yeah. It's one of the only things that a vast supermajority of the country can agree on is that they don't like CNN and they don't like the mainstream media. It's become a punching bag and a lightning rod for many, many things, some of which it is responsible for, some of which it obviously isn't.
I'm speaking to Andrew Marantz of The New Yorker about what he's written in his article, Is Trump Trolling the White House Press Corps? It's in the March 20th issue of The New Yorker. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. One newcomer to the White House Press Corps is a man named Lucian Wintrit, an ardent Trump supporter. But he's gay and he went to Bard.
Yeah.
How did he wind up supporting Trump?
I think going to Bard had a lot to do with it. I spent a lot of time with Lucian, and one of the things he told me is he was tired of being told what he couldn't say, what he couldn't do. He was tired of being told that Trump was homophobic when he didn't see evidence of that. And at a certain point, he kind of snapped and said, not only am I not on board with this, you know, in his view, PC progressive agenda, but I'm swinging all the way to the other side.
But what are his credentials for joining the press corps? He is described as creative by day and a party host at night.
Yeah. He doesn't have many. I mean, then again, I don't really either have much formal training. What I will say is that a lot of times the job of White House correspondent is a job that you get after having many other introductory entry-level jobs, which in Lucian's case and in many other floaters' case is not what happens. But short of his formal training in journalism, which he lacks, he also doesn't see it as his job to actually dig up new information. And he and I had lots of long sort of recursive talks about this where he would say, no, my job is to troll the media. I'm in the room to make the mainstream media freak out and to point out how biased they are and how out of touch they are. And so my job is to criticize them. My job is not to ask the administration anything.
So he sees himself as a provocateur?
Yeah, he sees himself as a troll.
Well, troll and provocateur are pretty much the same thing.
Yeah.
And right now, since in his case, he's just creating a new brand, what would the brand ultimately wind up getting him?
It's already gotten him a lot. He appears on TV a lot. He'll probably be able to sell books at some point. It also accomplishes something of a longstanding agenda, which goes back to Andrew Breitbart and many people before him, which is attacking the media gets you lots of things. It gives you a good foil, a good enemy. It increases the amount of attention you get. It unites people.
Lucian was told you were brought in to troll the press corps, and you better troll hard.
Yeah, he's been doing it. So I spent a week with him in the press briefing room. I wrote my piece. We closed the piece. It was ready to come out in the magazine the following Monday. That Friday, before the piece came out, Lucian went into the briefing room and had a physical confrontation with one of the reporters in there, a reporter from Fox Radio, who said, "You're a Nazi, you're a white supremacist."
Fox was calling him a right-winger.
Correct. Calling him a Nazi. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, he's not. But they, Lucian says that he was assaulted. Lucian doesn't really seem to be telling the truth that he was assaulted. He seems to be exaggerating. And yet there was, you know, if the goal of trolling is to, quote unquote, trigger people and to provoke them, he was very, very successful in that. Now, the argument would be that the people, that the Fox News guy and all these other people are trying to enforce a certain amount of norm following and a certain amount of legitimacy, that you don't have provocateurs in this room. So it's an interesting back and forth.
A number of listeners have been calling in. One wonders what you think of Lucian. Do you believe that this trolling is a good thing for America?
You could find silver linings in it. You know, obviously there's something nice about shaking things up and, you know, disrupting people's sense of comfort. And there is something, as one person said to me, someone referred to the front row reporters as a smug little cartel. There's something nice about seeing old smug traditions be challenged. And yet, I personally think that the disruption outweighs the benefits.
I'm going to quote another caller who wonders why there is a euphemistic language about Trump's outright lies. Is the press not allowed to call them lies?
The press calls them lies all the time.
But there were some newspapers that suggested that other phrases be used rather than lies.
Sure. Look, this is...
I'm uncomfortable saying you're a liar.
Sure. Well, the front page of the New York Times is. I mean, I think this is a very interesting example of how so much rage at Trump is misdirected as rage against the press. You hear this all the time when people say, why won't the press just report on his misdeeds? Why won't the press call him out when he does something bad? To which my answer usually is, they do. It just can't prevent him from instituting his agenda.
It was pointed out that in the case of Silvio Berlusconi in Italy, all of his scandals were reported in the press, and they didn't prevent him from staying in power for 11 years.
Watergate was reported before Nixon was reelected. Look, the press is not perfect. There's by no means, I understand why people are consistently enraged. There's plenty of euphemism. I understand the criticism about using euphemisms instead of the word lie, using euphemisms instead of the word hate, all these things. I totally get it. I just don't think that's where we should start our critique.
On the other hand, we're seeing people on the right being critical of the president. The Wall Street Journal's editorial this week was very hard on the president. Shepard Smith on Fox has been criticizing some of the things that we've been hearing from the White House. So there are people all across the political spectrum who are concerned.
Oh, absolutely. The spectrum goes way past the Wall Street Journal. I mean, Breitbart has been critical of the president. This new health care bill is getting a lot of heat from the right, from the right flank. So there's criticism on all sides. I think I guess what people in the briefing room would say is that criticism of any kind can be seen as good. The question is, are the facts being paid any attention to at all?
But getting back to the euphemisms, many people were concerned that the press is using the term alt-right instead of white supremacist.
Mm-hmm. Some people are white supremacists and some are not. Look, the term alt-right seems to be on its way out. Lucian doesn't use it. Lucian hates Richard Spencer. He's just as fond of watching Nazis getting punched on GIFs as anyone else is. So there are many more divisions within these parts of the spectrum than I think people tend to realize. I get that not wanting to use euphemisms has an important kind of Orwellian symbolism. And yet again, I think it's important to pay attention to the facts.
You spoke to John Roberts, who covered the White House for CBS News, then CNN. He's now the White House correspondent for Fox News. And he said, I've seen tension before between the press and the administration, but I've never seen such constant tension. A listener wonders if this isn't an opportunity for the press to gain credibility with some Americans.
I think so, and I think it's been happening. I think it's the press has been gaining subscribers as well as legitimacy. Of course, I think so. I think that it's a good opportunity. The question is, how ubiquitously well-received is that legitimacy? How much does it span political divides? How many people are listening? How many people... There is a huge segment of the people, and Trump is very, very aware of this. He often says this, you know, if you're the average person watching at home, you don't know what to believe. And so I'll tell you what to believe. So there are lots of people for whom CNN and the New York Times and the rest of these institutions have taken on a newly outsized importance. There are other people who just throw up their hands and say, look, there are competing narratives here. I don't know which one to subscribe to, so I'm out.
But we're only 2 months into this new administration, and already there's so much stuff going on. You almost have the feeling there's going to be some kind of burnout.
Yeah, I think many people have experienced burnout, and the burnout can work to the administration's advantage. If people are too fatigued to check and double-check and triple-check all the sources, if people don't have the bandwidth to listen to what the president says and then read a fact-checked version of what he said and then go back to the primary source and see whether the wiretapping claims are really grounded in fact, that's part of what the administration is banking on, is that people will throw up their hands and say, I'm just going to judge based more on my feeling or my intuition. That's where they win.
So you're saying that the trolling is a strategy?
Absolutely.
Andrew Marantz's latest piece is Trump trolling the White House press corps? It's in the March 20th issue of The New Yorker. Andrew, thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you. This was great.